Hi, welcome to the Wellness Doctors Podcast with Dr. Lorena
and Dr. Vanessa.
We are both medical doctors who talk about how to optimize health and well-being so that you can be empowered to make better healthy choices, enrich the lives of people around you, and join us in the evolution of healthcare. Hi everyone, this is the Wellness Doctors Podcast and I'm here with Vanessa and we have Lorena.
Hi everyone.
And today we have a guest from New York. So welcome, Eric.
Thank you very much. A little bit around the globe from you guys, but nice to connect.
Yeah. So Eric Kusin is the founder of hashtag Same Here Global Mental Health. And we're going to talk all about mental health today and how Eric's journey has led him to a very meaningful directive to help people view mental health differently and also find different ways of treatment that is more in line with what we want to do, which is holistic health and well-being and less of the, you know, old conventional way of viewing mental health. So I'll let Eric take the stage and maybe you can give us an introduction of yourself, your journey. Yeah, there you go.
Well, you guys stop me as I go, because with that directive, I could probably go on for days. But just because the experience has been so long, I'll try and, you know, crystallize it in a short amount. I wasn't involved in mental health at all. I was a professional sports executive for 15 years, NBA and NHL. And 6 months into my tenure with my most recent position, which was Chief Revenue Officer of the Florida Panthers, which is an NHL hockey team here in the U.S., my brain and my body hit a brick wall, meaning I almost ceased to function, like vegetable-like. You know, we talk about fight, flight, freeze mode. I was in freeze mode and just didn't know it at the time, other than how scary it was that my brain wasn't functioning and my body's directives in terms of movements relative to my brain wasn't functioning either. And to have that happen to you very quickly, you know, short period of time, after functioning quote normally, was scary. You know, I didn't know if I had a brain tumor, traumatic brain injury from playing sports when I was younger that was finally manifesting itself. From a historical perspective, this was 2015. So if we think people still aren't talking about mental health now, people certainly weren't talking about it then. So I didn't know what mental health could do to someone. And so I went back to New York, where I'm originally from, my family's from, because I needed help. I mean, I literally holding my hand, walking me to doctors. And, you know, in New York, it's this central hub of what they call top doctors from Columbia and Cornell and Harvard. And so you go see the top doctors and getting the same answer from all of them, which is, you know, you've got a shitload of depression or anxiety or PTSD or OCD or ADD or ADHD. And every doctor you're seeing, you know, is throwing an alphabet of terms at you because the brain is complicated. And when the brain stops working, a specialist can pretty much find in you a symptom that fits something that they've studied before, right? So that took me on this odyssey and this path of 2.5 years of being fed over 50 different psychotropic drug combinations as I laid in the bed that I grew up in as a child, a twin bed at 6'4", 240 pounds, not exactly the most pleasant experience. And I'll only give that visual, not for people to feel bad for me, but just to say, like, nothing mattered. I was just laying there staring at a ceiling. I wasn't watching TV. I wasn't listening to the radio. I was just dead to the world. My brain wasn't turned on. I had to be reminded to eat. And 2.5 years probably sounds like a ridiculously long time to go through it. But when you don't have any other answers and your brain's just not functioning, you don't know where else to turn, right? So if, you know, if anything did come to mind, it was, how am I going to get out of this? I think I'm trying my hardest because I'm willing to try new meds every 4 to 6 weeks. We're told here in the U.S., you know, it's different here in New Zealand are the two spots where the pharmaceutical companies promote to us directly. So you see these commercials where someone has a sad face for 15 seconds and then a smiley face for the final 15 seconds of the commercial after popping a pill. Why would we think any different? And if you compare it to what happens when we grow up, we have strep throat, bronchitis, pneumonia, right? And we get this magic pill called an antibiotic and we feel better. So we're indoctrinated into this system where when you don't feel well, you need to find the right medication that's going to make you feel well. So the brain felt no different at that time. And all the messages that we were getting from the marketers, you know, on Madison Avenue about how we get better when our brain doesn't feel right was take this pill because your brain is a soup of chemicals and you have to find the right ingredients to make the soup taste the right way again. Right. Again, that didn't work. So I then was told to do TMS therapy, transcranial magnetic stimulation, where they put a helmet on your head and shoot electromagnetic waves into your brain. You're told to do it every single day for 45 minutes. It's an outpatient office. And it's $350 a session. It's not covered by insurance. So if you have any savings, good luck to anyone who's trying to hold on to whatever money they had. And look, I would have spent anything to feel better. So that's just the sidebar part of the story. But 23 sessions in, I couldn't fall asleep that night of the 23rd. And then the morning of the 24th, about 4 a.m, you know, I'm literally finding myself sitting on my hands like this because I'm having this repetitive message in my head, looking at this bottle of pills, and the message is swallow that bottle. And I hadn't had a suicidal ideation like that ever in my life. Of course, I think like most people, if we're being honest, you pass over a bridge or a train comes by or you look at a knife and your mind for 1/19th of 1 second says, what would happen if, right? But to have that thought with the bottle trapped in your mind was scary as could be. And I think it's interesting the juxtaposition of knowing you don't want to do that, not making a plan the way that, you know, the powers that be say that suicide happens, and then just having this thought overcome me and feeling like I needed to lunge and do that. And fortunately, I had the rational part of my brain on enough to be able to reach out to family and say, you got to take me to a hospital because I can't stop myself from this thought. And so I went inpatient to a psych ward. I won't mention the name of the hospital to not throw them under the bus, but other than to say it's supposed to be the top treatment facility center here in the Northeast, it's one of. And I met with the attending psychiatrist the first day, and she looks at my chart and says, Eric, you've tried everything there is. Your last resort is to do shock therapy. And to hear from a doctor, last resort, is probably the kiss of death to most people who are struggling with their mental health. Because what people who are struggling with their mental health at the time need is they need hope. They need options. They need to know that it's possible to feel better. They don't need to be told this is the last thing you can try. Especially, you know, we'll talk about later on in this with, you know, more natural practices and multiple practices that are out there. As a patient, you don't know other things exist. So you hear this doctor say it, and, you know, how many people are out there, especially this is now 2017, now that this is happening, you don't have friends who've been like, hey, when I went through shock therapy, this is what I did, or when these options were presented to me. So you listen to what the expert says. And I did, you know, 12 sessions over 5 weeks of getting my brain shocked under general anesthesia. And I leave the hospital. I'm skipping over the details of that for the purposes of brevity. But I leave the hospital feeling no better than I had, you know, the 2.5 years prior, retreating back to that twin bed, thinking my life is over because she told me that was my last resort. And unless Merck or Pfizer, one of these big pharmaceutical companies, comes up with a magic pill that treats this thing called treatment-resistant depression of, you know, what I'm now being labeled with by the hospital. And how fun is it to be told that you're treatment-resistant, right? That my life is over. And so here's where the story starts to turn. I meet an integrative psychologist through my parents, you know, just networking, trying to find help. But I didn't know what the term integrative meant. And so I sat in her couch. And first thing she asked me, very different than every other doctor I'd been to at that point, where every doctor's first question was, hey, Eric, nice to meet you. What are your symptoms, right? Brain fog, cognitive malaise, you know, can't think straight. She didn't ask me anything about my symptoms. She's like, Eric, tell me about you. I want to get to know you, the person. And, you know, when it was presented that way, I was able to open up and share you know, she wanted me to go my earliest memories, which to me were back to like 7, 8 years old. And then it just starts pouring out of me, like how I remember my childhood, right? Because you're not usually asked that question by friends. Like you meet someone, they're like, what's your relationship with your parents like? Are you a family guy? You know, like it's usually like a little more specific. This was just tell me about your life. And so from the time I was 8, I have an older brother and younger brother. The older brother breaks his femur bone in a sporting accident and was put in a body cast for a year and homeschooled. Heals from that, and a month later gets diagnosed with ALL, children's form of leukemia. So 5 years of chemo and radiation in the late 80s, which is not, you know, a guarantee by any means. Yeah, like certainly, you know, a risky endeavor. But miraculously goes into remission after 5 years. We're all celebrating. Well, he's in a Jeep Wrangler with his friends, open top, open back. Car loses control. He flies out of the back, lands on his head on the parkway, cracks his head open, loses partial vision in his eye, is in ICU for a month. Heals from that, goes to college, is feeling a pain in his knee, gets all this testing done. They determine that his leukemia from childhood has now come back. So it's a relapse of leukemia. They have to give him a much stronger chemo regimen and knock the chemo out of his, cancer out of his body. And what we know about chemo is while it does a great job of knocking the cancerous cells out, it also attacks, unfortunately, many of the healthy cells. So he's dealing with like the normal side effects of chemo of losing your hair, but his joints are breaking down. He's difficulty walking. And I guess it was such a strong dose that his body goes into what's called septic shock. And, you know, he's got 105 fever at the hospital, goes into septic shock. And then we all arrive at the hospital and the neurologists tell us that he's fallen into a coma. And so we go to see him. There's a tube breathing for him. And the neurologist is saying, we don't know if he's going to wake or if he's going to have any brain activity. And if he does wake, you know, you don't know what his quality of life is going to be. So that was going on for 1 month, then 2 months, then 3 months that he's in the coma. He finally wakes at the end of 3 months, miraculously has his full cognitive faculties about him, but his kidneys fail from the rigor of the septic shock and he has to go on dialysis. We all get tested to see who's the closest donor match. My father is, donates a kidney to him. That all ends, you know, knock on wood, you're like, okay, in the clear, get my job at the NBA league office right out of college myself. And that first year working, three of my close friends, 22 and 23 years old, just freak things, all pass away within the same year of heart conditions. Like one on a treadmill, 6 a.m, his wife was 6 weeks pregnant at the time. So, you know, I share that because I'd never shared that story linearly like that. It was just, that was what was coming out of me when she was asking me about what it was like growing up. Now, keep in mind, what I just shared happened to me between the ages of 8 and 23, and I'm 35 when I'm in her office. So I don't have any idea that what I'm sharing with her has any relationship to why the hell I've been feeling the way I felt for the last 2.5 years. But her first question to me is, Eric, is there anything else that happened to you in your childhood that impacted your mental health that you would need to tell me about? And I said, what do you mean impacted my mental health? I wasn't in the car with my brother. I wasn't on the treadmill with my friends. These things didn't happen to me. They happened to them. And you could, you know, obviously a very ignorant take right now how much I know about mental health. But at the time, it's how I felt. And she's like, Eric, you know, you had a front row seat for all these events. And when you have a front row seat for all these events, the way that the stress of those events and the trauma of those events accumulate and build in your system, it's like this heavy backpack that just absolutely took you down by the time you were 35 because of the accumulation of all of it. And you hadn't done anything to get rid of it, to rewire it, to release it out. Who the hell learns those things, right? You don't, at school, they don't teach us that. And certainly society doesn't tell us that. So my immediate reaction was, okay, I'm 35. Take the average 15-year-old. If you're telling me that all that is required to feel this thing called mental health declines is to, you know, watch other people in your life go through things, well, then a 15-year-old whose parents fight and get a divorce, or whose parents lose their job and then potentially lose the house, or whose best friends fight and that friendship breaks up, or whose best friend gets into a fight with their significant other and that relationship breaks up and they're devastated, or who watches their friend being verbally abused in the schoolyard or being bullied or hears about their friend being sexually abused or watches their friend deal with the sickness of a loved one or a loss of a loved one. I was like, I can keep going on if you want. The list is pretty long. That sounds to me like mental health also then. And if that's mental health, find me a person on this planet, 15 years of age, maybe even younger than that, that hasn't dealt with mental health challenges. That sounds like it's everyone. And that's not the message that we're getting. And so she, you know, just started shaking her head and said, Eric, you know, I listen, I'm an integrative practitioner, believe in a mind-body connection and multiple ways in which we can heal because our bodies are impacted from the stuff that we see and we take in over life. I agree with you. Let's get you better first before you start thinking about like everyone else. She sends me to a weekend breathing course that Dr. Lorraine, knows a lot about, called The Art of Living. I didn't know much about it. And I show up to this karate studio where I'm the only man, only one under 40 and only one born in this country. So it's me and 8 Indian women and 9 yoga mats. And I'm wearing like a cut sleeve basketball t-shirt and basketball shorts, but, I ended up becoming great friends with these women who were there. And obviously this practice called the Sudha Harshan Kriya, which was created by a guy named Sri Sri Ravi Shankar out of India, it's part of their culture. So this is stuff that they know and they do, right? When I say part of their culture, to be fair, India is a very large country, right? It's not like everyone there practices this and know this, because I know the work that you all are doing. But for the group of people who do practice it, it's second nature to them, which is our central nervous systems get affected over time. They get polluted. And how do you cleanse them? And what do you do to the vagus nerve, right, as you breathe, in order to normalize your central nervous system? And that was the first kind of light bulb that went off in my mind of like, okay, if you can heal from this, that's a very divergent message from what that doctor in the hospital told me that shock therapy was my last resort. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a lot of different healing modalities that are out there. And so I did their, you know, Sudha Harshan Kriya at home they asked me to stick with it for 40 days, you know, I did it 30 days straight. And on the 30th day, I woke up and it was like Christmas friggin' morning. Like, you know, I looked at my controller and I wanted to turn my TV on. I looked at my kitchen and I wanted to make scrambled eggs for breakfast. And that was desire, something that I hadn't felt in 2.5 years. It felt amazing. And so as I started to heal by doing the breathing practice, a couple things happened. I wanted to share my story, and I wasn't a social media person. So I put my very long story, believe it or not, as much as I'm talking right now, a lot longer than what I'm sharing with you right now. It takes 35 minutes to read it. And I look, my friends, here's the funny joke. My friends who are in digital marketing are like, you've been dead for 2.5 years to the world. Like, people use video now and short form. No one's going to read this thing. And I didn't have Instagram or Twitter, so I put it on LinkedIn, and it gets read over 150,000 times in 3 days. And I get over 400 calls from as far as China. And the calls that are coming through to me as I'm taking, I still have the Excel spreadsheet that I saved from all the calls that were coming in. There was no one sharing a disorder label. No one was saying, Eric, you were ultimately diagnosed with CPTSD. I have that too. Or Eric, I have bipolar. It's different than PTSD in this way. Instead, everyone was sharing a lived experience story with me. Like, I lost a child to SIDS 5 years ago and I've never been the same. Or, you know, I'm a married mother of 2 beautiful kids. My husband is my soulmate, but I broke up with my boyfriend in college 10 years ago. And that morning there was this knot in my stomach because I knew I was changing the course of both of our lives forever. And that knot I wake up with every single morning, even though I know I'm with the right person, right? Which is heavy shit when you're not a therapist to hear. But what that made me realize was the common thread that ties the human experience together is not disorder, it's not labels, it's challenging life events. And we all go through them at different levels and at different times in our lives, but we all go through them. And if that's the common thread, why the hell is that not how we explain mental health to people? Why is mental health explained through the disorder model, the disease model, the DSM-5? And I would hope would be the most benevolent of the groups out there, the largest nonprofits in our country here in the US. And I just start taking inventory. I'm a marketer, right? So I start taking inventory of what's being marketed on their websites. And it's like consistency across all of them with the same, and I want to believe it was well-intentioned, then this isn't choreographed, but all the messages were the same in terms of the from a macro standpoint. There, and three in particular that I felt like actually moved us further away as a society from actually understanding this topic the right way. So those three things, the first was, they all start with the statistic, 1 in 5 people are mentally ill, which if you start with that statistic, immediately you're writing off 80% of the population saying, by the way, this topic isn't for you because you're this thing called healthy, fine, normal, and okay. You're not mentally ill, so don't pay attention, right? And by the way, it's more than 80% because by their own admission, the pharmaceutical companies and all those who project the 1 in 5 say that 50% of the people who would have a diagnosable mental illness don't get help. So let's raise that number to 90%. 9 to 10 people don't pay attention to mental health. Okay, that's problem number one. Problem number two was all the campaigns to try to normalize conversation were an action word followed by stigma. So it started with stop the stigma, and then it became stomp the stigma, break the stigma, erase the stigma. And you look at that and you say, okay, if the three of us were forming the Lorena, Vanessa, and Eric, you know, mental health organization, stop the stigma is a great rallying cry for us. It's probably the worst rallying cry on the planet for the 4 in 5 people that don't know mental health, because like, wait a second, stigma means people are forming opinions and judgments unfairly about another group of people. You're saying stop it. Is that directed at me? The people who don't feel like they're part of your Vanessa, Lorena, and Eric group? Yeah, who else would we be, you know, directing that? Okay, well, stop pointing the finger at me. All it does is push us further into binary groups, the sick people and the people who are making fun of the sick people, right? And then the third thing was the way in which all the celebrity stories were being shared. You know, there was an excitement level from these nonprofits. Britney Spears is part of our 1 in 5 group. She's got depression. Lindsay Lohan is part of our 1 in 5 group. She's got anxiety. And then they would link to an Us Weekly or People magazine article. And it was like, Britney Spears has depression, shaves her head. Lindsay Lohan has anxiety, dresses like a hot mess. And you're like, okay, so let me get this straight from these websites. To understand the topic of mental health, it's for 1 in 5 people. We need to stop stigmatizing that 1 in 5. And that 1 in 5 looks like people who shave their heads, run off basketball courts and panic attacks, say crazy things about their family, walk around the streets with their shirts off, or don't know how to put lipstick on their face the right way. Okay, sign me up. I want to learn about this mental health thing because I'm part of that group, right? Well, that's why no one pays attention to this crap. And even to this day, you know, with more and more celebrities talking, all they're doing is reinforcing the same, because there's not a level of vulnerability where they're opening up. They're saying, I'm Michael Phelps. I have depression and suicidal thoughts. Use Talkspace to feel better. Is that vulnerable? Does that help anyone understand, hey, this relationship with my mother when I was younger was really difficult. When I lost my friend when he was 14 years old, that's impacted me till this day, right? That's the type of vulnerability that's needed to get people to understand what mental health is. And that's not what's happening. So anyway, landing the plane on my long intro is, you know, I realized we needed different messaging out there. And so it started with a pretty provocative name, I guess, if you will, in this space, which is, we're all a little crazy in quotes. You know, that was a term, you can't use the term crazy in this space. Okay, well, we'll put quotes around it. The A will be upside down in the logo. We're going to say we're all a little bit crazy, you know, meaning we're all part of this. Mental health lives across a continuum. It's not for 1 in 5. It's for 5 in 5. How am I going to shake the trees on the 4 in 5? By using a term like crazy, because I can say, Lorena, that virtual background behind you is crazy cool. And you know, I'm not saying that virtual background is mentally ill. I'm saying it's crazy cool because I use the term crazy. There was a wackiness and a zaniness to it that people appreciated. And then from that, okay, what would be our campaign? And you know, as you introduced me, Vanessa, Same Here Global. Same Here is an American Sign Language sign that looks like this. Like, I'm pointing at myself and I'm pointing at you. And I'm saying, you and I were the same. And I can confidently say that if I speak to a stranger or if I speak to my best friend that I've known for, you know, 40 years. Why? Because I know as a human, you've been through challenging life events just like I have. That makes us the same, makes us part of the same group. And when people are the same, as opposed to stop the stigma of one group against the other, when we're the same, we come together based on our commonalities and we want to solve things and work on things. So yeah, that's been the, you know, the last 3.5 years of my life after working in sports has been, how do I find ways to connect people and alliances, which we can get into, and organizations and programming to get this message out there? Because what's currently happening is only reinforcing more of the same, which is keeping us in the dark and separated.
Yeah, well done, Eric. You managed to summarize your life in 20 minutes. So I think we couldn't have done a better intro than yourself. And it's a really touching story, I have to say. It really resonates with me because, I mean, as a psychiatrist, I see people who come and yes, they've got what we call life events, right? Or adverse childhood events. And all these events, we kind of put them in a category and go, okay, yep, you've got this. Oh yeah, you had a traumatic incident and now you have depression or now you have PTSD. We still kind of just use it as you put it into the biopsychosocial thing and it's a precipitating factor, it's a risk factor. It's all very clinical. We're not looking at people as if they're humans. We're just looking at it as a case study. And then all you want to do is to build up enough evidence to give them a diagnostic code so that you can prescribe. And sometimes when I hear patients tell me their stories, and it's an honor to have someone open up to you. I mean, essentially, I'm a stranger they're paying, which is kind of like a weird concept. Like, why would I go and see someone I've never met and open up my deepest, darkest secrets? But when they do, I said, look, if your friend went through the same thing, how would they feel? What would you say to them? And trying to normalize some of their feelings helps them, because a lot of the times they get sent to the psychiatrist because they've exhausted all avenues of finding out what's physically wrong with them. They've gone around all these medical doctors and done all these tests. They're told that it's not physical, it's in their head. So go see a psychiatrist and get an antidepressant, which I had two of these patients today. And I said, look, yeah, you may have this pain and this pain is real to you, but the pain is not necessarily coming from your body. It's coming from your mind. And you go dig back into their life events. And sometimes you may not find anything at first glance. So you kind of have to work with that. But a lot of the times people just have life stories and
life is not always rosy. So it's interesting because you brought up adverse childhood experiences, right? Like this whole movement towards ACE scores. And I'm going to call it that. I 50% believe in it. And then 50% think that it falls short completely, right? Because you said, well, when we dig, sometimes we find, sometimes we don't. So I'm going to give two scenarios that no one would ever bring up on an ACE score. I'm 3 years old and I'm on an airplane and it has this thing called turbulence. Well, I've been in a car before as a three-year-old and it's been bouncy on a road that's not paved well. And I've been afraid because my mom and dad look at each other and they're scared when we're on the bouncy road that we might hit another car. Now I'm bouncy on a plane and I see that we're 30,000 feet in the sky. Not that a three-year-old knows what 30,000 feet is, but they're really high up. And their mind goes to, oh my God, if a car can get into an accident, what happens to a plane? They don't have the words to explain that to their parents. And then every time they see a plane in the sky, which is every single day, where they go to Disney World once a year with their parents and their parents are all excited, but they're like, oh my God, that plane that could fall out of the sky at any moment, I have to go back on that thing. And then they're afraid to talk about it. And then that builds inside of them for 30 years because they don't know to talk about it. That's trauma. So there's one example. Then you get, here's example number two. Let's say Lorena and Vanessa were friends growing up. And your moms are walking you and holding your hands on the street at 5 years old. And Lorena turns to the left with her mom to go to one store. And Vanessa turns to the right to go to another store with her mom. And on the street that Lorena turns down, a car loses control and jumps onto the curb. Doesn't hit anyone. Doesn't even hit a pole. But just jumps on the curb because it lost control. Lorena sees that and says, oh my God, we walk on the sidewalks all the time. and a car can always lose control. If we were there 10 seconds earlier, I would have been hit by that car. And now all of a sudden, everywhere Lorena walks, she's afraid that a car is going to lose control and going to hit her. And she's thinking about that over and over and over again. And again, doesn't have the words or the vocabulary to be able to describe that. And now that lives in her head for all that time. So it's like they're...
It's like I described
my brother, but life is a series of like ridiculous things that can happen, do happen. We experience, we watch, we concoct in our head. These are all things that build in the accumulation of the stuff that's inside of us. And I don't think we take into consideration as a society enough how much sometimes we are our own worst enemy. And it's not just the exactly within the ACE score alone. Okay, dealt with divorce of parents at a young age, check the box there. There's so many other things that contribute to it as well.
And the examples you gave, I think, I always try to think of why our body or our mind does a certain thing that seems to be counterproductive, because I believe our body and our minds are efficient. We've evolved to survive. So there must be a survival benefit to having these recurrent thoughts or remembering traumatic experiences, because essentially you learn from experiences. So if I learn something good and it helps me in the future, then obviously that is a positive thing. But a negative event also helps, and we have a negative bias, because if something can potentially kill me, I need to be very aware of it the next time it potentially happens. So your brain tends to focus on these negative events. The problem with these events is that if you're still feeling it today, it's almost like you're still living on the day it happened. And you can have a memory of it, but the emotional pain and the emotional connection with it is still alive today, as if you were living that day. So I think a lot of the recovery needs to be around how do we dissociate and be more present and say, look, I'm an adult now. I can protect myself. I don't need to be that little child. I don't need to live and relive that experience. I can remember it as an, you know, the analogy I give is like it's like taking a video or a picture and put it on Instagram and you hashtag a lot of stuff around it. But as an adult, you can go back and change the hashtags. You can't necessarily change the picture or the memory of it, but you can rewire your brain and learn to process these emotions. And working through life events or traumas or whatever you want to call it is part of what we are as humans. And I don't believe that this model of medicating life, as I call it, should be how we treat people with difficulties.
Well, not only should it not be that, it's not working. Like, here's the rinse, wash, repeat model of the medication model. It's patient comes in, to your point, Vanessa, they've tried other things and they're sent to a psychiatrist feeling, you know, I'm going to throw out a ridiculous number that you can't really measure, but they're feeling 72% of themselves, right? And so they say, doc, I'm feeling this, this, and this. You got to help me. And the doctor says, okay, well, this sounds like depression. Okay, you know, Prozac or Zoloft, Lexapro, right? Whatever it is. They prescribe it. In the cases, because it's not every case, in the cases where the four-week transition period to your brain getting used to a reuptake inhibitor, right, for everyone out there, you're not getting serotonin. You're getting something that blocks serotonin from being reabsorbed so there's more readily available in your brain to use. And if it works for you, you go from feeling 72% to feeling now 82% of yourself. And you're like, wow, it feels so much better to feel 10% better. Well, first off, the question is, why are you only feeling 82% and not 85 or 90 or 95, right? Okay, fine. But patient's okay because it's 10% better and it's so much better than it was before. Patient and doctor are high-fiving and then life continues to happen. And the 82% starts dipping to 75 and then 75 back down to 72. And then the patient goes into the doctor, says, doc, this was working for me for 5 months. What happened? It's not working anymore. Well, the medication may have pooped out for you, right? That's what's being told, right? The medication just stopped working for you. We need to give you a booster. We need to give you Abilify or Rexulti. Supercharge the SSRI. And then you take that. And then that doesn't work. And then now you're dipping to 65% and 62%. And the doctor says, well, maybe we just need to change your medication completely. And then they put you on a different drug and rinse, wash, repeat over and over and over again. And you reach, I kind of look at it almost as holding trauma back with a Band-Aid that is a piece of tissue paper in your brain. And if the trauma is being held somewhere in the brain, eventually it builds up to a certain place where that tissue paper breaks, because the if you think of trauma almost as like air in a balloon, this air in your brain fills up to a certain point, the pressure eventually breaks through that piece of tissue paper that's trying to hold it back from affecting your brain the way that it does. Now, guess what? Once there's enough of it in there and you're not releasing or rewiring it out, that piece of tissue paper, which was the medication, can't do anymore what it did when it got you from 72 to 82%. So you could try every friggin' drug in the world, because I did it, and it's not going to just repair the piece of tissue paper. You actually have to work on the air that's built up and release and rewire it out. And we're not doing that as a society. It's like, and then we wonder, why do people continue to dip and then go into psychotic episodes, or unfortunately have suicidal thoughts and we lose them to suicide? This is why. This is this model that we're in right now. And it's scary. It's so scary that this is what's the norm.
So actually, I'm really curious, because after you've gone through 50 combos of medications, you started the breathing course, and maybe Lorena can also help explain this. So what was it about the breathing course that changed it for you? What did you feel, anything different? Did you just feel something clicked, or how did you feel coming out of that?
It's a great question. Thanks for asking. And Lorena, certainly, you know, chime in if you feel differently or have something to add to it. So I believe that to heal, we as humans want to know what we're doing that is helping us in this process of what we're doing. What is it doing to change our body and our brain in a positive way? Because that's what's going to make us stick with it. If you didn't tell people that, hey, getting on the treadmill and running your butt off for 45 minutes and sweating, the first day you do it, guess what? You're not going to get on the scale and lose this thing called fat or plaque that's built up in your arteries. That's one day worth of hard work. You're going to have to do that for 30 days straight, and you're only going to lose 2 pounds if you eat this diet along with it. We've explained that to people now. People generally understand that. As much as it sucks that you have to run for 30 days to lose those 2 pounds, you do it because you understand it. The problem with today with alternate modalities, as they call it, Eastern functional holistic alternative, that's why we have the name STAR that we use, stress and trauma, active release and rewiring, is so that people understand what you're actually doing. So in this course, what I learned from this practitioner, I learned about the vagus nerve, right? In the neck, 2 branches coming from the brainstem down to the stomach. And this is not how he would explain it, but this is how I would take what was explained to me. If the three of us were in a room together and a car crashed through a window because it lost control in the street, and none of us were physically hurt, but we'd all do this when we saw the car crash, right? Well, then we're changing the way we're breathing. And that car coming through the window is all the things that happen to us in life. My child is sick. He's getting bullied at school. I fear for if he's going to harm himself. My parent has stage 3 cancer. I'm afraid it's going to turn to stage 4, or I'm going to hear they're going into hospice, right? So subconsciously, we don't realize it. We're not breathing the way that we, quote, normally would, right? So without that angst on our mind. And so it made sense to me. We watch things with our brain. We've got this vagus nerve, which is this carrier messenger to the rest of our body of what's happening, that when we change our breath, the tense nature of that vagus nerve, it's either going to tense up or it's going to loosen. And when it's loosened, it's called greater vagal tone, that's able to tell the rest of our body, chill out, everything's going to be okay, right? So if I am able to breathe properly, and this is the analogy that I made in my mind,
myself understand is
if I go to the gym and I want to, you know, put muscles on, you can work out with weights generally a lot more than this, but 3 different ways. You could do really heavy weights and try to build your muscles big. You can do medium weights and just try and get in general good shape. You can do really light weights and do them fast and quick to build your fast twitch muscle fibers. You're giving your muscles this range of motion to be flexible. That type of flexibility is what's needed in the breathing patterns that you learn, and what the Sudha Harshan Kriya is. It's long breaths for 20, medium breaths for 40, very short breaths and quick for 40, and that on repeat three different times. I'm obviously oversimplifying what the process is, but it made sense to me that I'm working out this vagus nerve so that I have what's called flexibility, that whatever the life situation is that's happening, I'm not getting locked in one phase of that. It's telling my body, shit's going to happen again, shit's going to happen again, because it's always happened. And then my body and my brain always need to be on high alert. Lorena, hopefully I did a decent service to Sudarshan Kriya, but that's the way that my American brain understands the process.
Yeah, it's a really interesting course, because I think it's hard to explain what exactly happens. But, you know, after I think it's something you really have to go to experience it. And I think anybody who every day basically faces challenges, it's actually a really great way to understand how your body is reacting to stress. Because once you actually start doing the technique and the breathing, you realize how shallow our day-to-day breathing actually is. And the practice itself actually brings attention and awareness to the present moment, because it focuses on the rate of the breathing, the different sort of short, long, medium types of breathing. So there's actually a lot of focus that's being put on the present. And one of the things that is a really great strategy for the fight, flight, freeze type of reaction that often we're involved every day is to actually, that's very sympathetic. So that's part of the autonomic nervous system, which is not part of our conscious control. And so when we're in facing a challenge, or we're facing something scary, or witnessing something that's very traumatic, the sympathetic nervous system actually gets activated. And so normally if that danger is past and we're not re-experiencing it, or we're not remembering it, or we're not recreating it, we actually go back into a more parasympathetic, which is the more restful, the more vagal tone type of mode. And generally for well-being and for the body to be able to repair and to rest and to digest, absorb nutrients, we pretty much want to be more in that parasympathetic state. So if our autonomic nervous system, which is the combination of the parasympathetic and the sympathetic, is constantly overactive in the sympathetic state, then we're constantly under breathing, so we're very shallow breathing, and we're often fearful, we're often focused on all the negative things, because like Vanessa said, that system has actually helped us survive as human beings. We're much more focused on the negative so that we can survive and run away from it. But today it's not really the saber-toothed tiger. It's not really those types of things that are creating stress. It's actually your boss's emails. It's constant phone calls. It's looking at people yelling at each other. It's social media, news that are negative. So we're constantly being exposed to those negative, things. And often our attentions are actually not focused on the present moments. Like how often are people actually eating, talking at the same time on the computer? We're often living in a society where we're expected to switch between tasks all the time because we have had access to technology. So I think in some ways that's also created a lot more anxiety, because people are afraid that they're going to miss out on something if they're not connected all the time. So we're not really practicing a sense of being, which is just presence and just observing our thoughts. We're often expected to react to things because, you know, you go on social media, an ad pops up, and then, you know, you click on it, or, you know, these days they can pretty much read what you're focusing your attention to. So you've got multiple things happening at the same time that's popping up on your website. And it's very distracting. So we're often hijacked by all these external stimulus and things that are going on around us. And so what I have found is really interesting, and when I went to look back at the study of Sudarshan Kriya, is that it's being utilized in cases where people are experiencing post-traumatic stress, in depression. They've measured blood levels of your immune system, how it actually helps to balance it, how it reduces inflammation. So this act of breathing, this process of breathing, and it's not really just with the art of living, but there are many kinds of different deep breathing, diaphragm breathing. And the whole purpose is that it does help to, it helps to activate that vagus nerve. And it helps our minds to bring our minds back into the present moment, to focus on that. And I think the more we try to do that, that's one of the strategies that really help us balance out the stresses and the negative things that we're witnessing all the time. So that's really kind of like how I experienced it. And I went and did this practice because I thought, well, okay, you know, what is this about? And what is this breathing? And, you know, I've always been a really great, like, big advocate of like deep breathing, and it's one of the things that I was taught when I went through internship, because it's such a stressful situation that one of the counselors that we had as interns taught me deep breathing, and actually just scanning my body and noticing breath. And it was something really powerful, and I learned to utilize that when I was actually in situations that was like requiring a lot of immediate reaction. Or sometimes you'd be in a situation where people are arguing, or you could be a very angry patient or very violent patient, or something violent happening. And every single time I noticed that, I was able to just take a deep breath, step back, observe the situation, not react too quickly, observe my own emotions and my own thoughts. And I think the Sudarshan Kriya really kind of honed that in and helped me to become much more systematic in the way that the process actually you go through. So I think, yeah, I've recommended it to a lot of my own patients without any mental health, without any mental illness, but really just as a strategy to help them understand why they're overthinking, why they're sort of like focused and overactive in their minds. And it was a really great way for them to learn how to take a step back, observe their thoughts and the situation, and then be able to react to it in a different way, because things happen around us. We have no control over that, but we do have control over how we react to it. And I think this is a great knowledge when we go through this course. So that's kind of my experience of it.
Which is fascinating, because it's obviously an ancient Eastern practice, but a lot of the Western world has now taken on a lot of Eastern knowledge, or South American, or, you know, sort of more, I guess, exotic ways of looking at it from the Western traditional medicine point of view. So how do we look at East meeting West in mental health? Like, because we're from Asia and you're a New Yorker. So like, let's share how we look at things, because I think it's going to be interesting to see how, as the world grows smaller, and for example, with the hashtag same here, it's turning into a global movement. Yeah. But does the message translate over culturally is also something I've thought about.
Yeah, look, you know, why same here and how do you make it transfer over globally is, the reason we use a sign language sign is because it's universal, right? I could speak a completely different language than you, but when you see me pointing back and forth between you and I, and then from day one, when we launched it, we had people in front of the Great Wall of China. We had people in front of the Wall in Jerusalem. We had people in front of the Sydney Opera House, all looking different, being different ages, dressed differently, all making the sign. And yeah, it's a little bit like cliche of one world, you know, one message, right? But here's the thing. What it takes to normalize is it takes the shock level of seeing people in situations that you wouldn't expect now in those situations. So one of the best images I remember when I first started healing was, there's this guy named Eddie George who played running back for the Houston Oilers at the time. That was their name before they became the Texans. He's 6'4" like me, but even, I mean, he is a muscular brick shithouse, they call it here. Just a big guy, shaved head, and he's on a mat doing a warrior pose with a football next to him on the mat, right? That's not usually what you see when you see yoga. When you see yoga, you usually see like a petite woman in Lululemon pants, right? Looking cute on the mat. Like, so we need to show people in different places, right? Which is why we have a celebrity alliance, right? It's not for the hoity-toityness of saying that we work with celebrities. It's because celebrities are able to, when they're genuine, right? And I want to be very specific there. There are certain celebrities we choose not to work with, despite having large followings, because a lot of the things that we spoke about earlier, just throwing out disorder labels and, you know, erratic behaviors, I think that actually moves us further away. I want the celebrities who are willing to say, I was sexually abused when I was younger. I dealt with a father who had a gambling addiction, and I watched that every day. And yeah, it was fun watching sports with him, but I got used to the up and down nature of betting on games, right? So you can normalize things through people's platforms who share the vulnerable nature of the things they've gone through, so that people can hear those stories and say, I've been through something similar, right? We have these motor neurons in our brains, which is what makes us human and is a special piece of being human. So we can relate to what other people have been through, even if it's not been our exact experience, and say, same here. I didn't experience that exactly, but you know, it happened to your aunt. Well, it happened to my cousin, right? Or it happened to you at 30. Well, it happened to me at 15, right? And we're able to connect in that way. That type of, like, talk about what social media can do for us. And I completely agree with you guys that, you know, the joke that I give is in 1996, we were happy when we turned on our computer and it said, you've got mail. And it was like, you had three emails that came in. You're like, oh my God, Aunt Missy sent me a note from Canada, right? Like, and it was like a big deal. You're getting that on steroids every second of every day because it's connected to your phone. And you're constantly looking. If you had three emails in a day, you'd be like, did people forget who I am, right? So our brains have had to adapt in such a short period of time, you know, 15, 20 years, where our brains don't evolve that quickly. Like we're living the same life. And then all of a sudden just the technology changed so quickly. So the need for storytelling to normalize what mental health is, to show the common nature across cultures, that opening an email is opening an email, whatever language you speak. Waiting for your boss, like you were saying, Lorena, you know, to put the hammer down because, you know, they don't like a project or they have a tighter deadline. That's a common thing that happens regardless of what culture you live in, right? Fearing the loss of loved ones is a common thing regardless of what culture you live in, that if you could normalize experiences and then through the experiences normalize being vulnerable about our experiences, because what's there to be shameful about when these experiences are handed to us? We don't choose them. So why not tell, right? Like, I don't mind sharing anything like that's happened to me. As you can hear, I'm pretty open book because I have no shame in any of those things. I didn't choose for my brother to be sick. I didn't choose for my friends to pass away. They happened to me, right? And so the normalization through that, and then the other piece of it is the normalization of the practices that help people get better. And I'd say those are stigmatized as much as talking about mental health is, because
it's like woo, you know, you're not conventional. If I tell people to breathe, they're like, that's just not a sexy solution.
But this is the
just
key,
give me a
right?
pill.
So one, it's work, right? To your point of give me the pill. But the other thing is, like, this is no disrespect. I won't mention the names of the companies, but you know who I'm talking about. The largest meditation apps in the world and breathing apps in the world. Their marketing messages to try and like hook you into doing these things are like, get 10% happier in 10 days, reduce your stress, right? Like, that's not going to get people to stay with something. It's going to get them to try it. But if you're not feeling better in 3 days after doing a breathing practice, you're going to be like, oh, I guess I'm not a meditator. I can't get myself there. We need to explain to people the process, like what Lorena just did, you know, with what I was sharing with the vagus nerve. Like, people need to understand you're working out your brain-body connection the same way if you go to the gym. You know, I use the losing weight example. When we build muscle, you have to break down muscle fibers and then the proteins build them back up stronger and bigger. People understand that now. And so when they go to the gym, same thing. They don't lift a weight, it hurts, and then say, why don't I look like Hulk Hogan the next day? Well, it's because it takes time for the muscles to keep building up, right? So there's a lot of education that needs to take place. And before education can take place, we have to change what people think what mental health is. So that's why I always start with the normalization part of the conversation of mental health is life experiences. It's what we go. I'm not trying to deny the genetic piece of it. We all have genetic coding underneath, but we don't have control over that, right? What we do at least understand is the stuff that we see, think, feel, and obsess over. We can start to understand, okay, these things are part of this kind of conglomerate of mush that's building up inside of me, this sludge that's building up inside of me. What do I need to do about that sludge? The same way when I put fat on my body, when my muscles start to get out of shape, I have to do something about it. Okay, what do I do about the sludge that builds in my central nervous system?
Sometimes I tell my patients mental hygiene should be like dental hygiene, because you brush your teeth, I presume, twice a day, but nobody stops to think why you do it. You just do. And if I said, well, why do you do it? And they think about it and they go, well, because if I don't, then I'll get really bad teeth. And I said, well, you don't have to brush, just go to the dentist then. And they're like, yeah, but I'm like, you see the point? Like, if you don't do your daily exercise, if you don't do your 5 minutes twice a day, you're going to end up in the psychiatrist's office and you get given, you know, treatments in terms of dental cavity fillings and root canal operations. So why would you not do mental hygiene every day?
Well, here's another wrinkle. Here's another wrinkle in that, Vanessa, which is interesting. Yes, people brush their teeth because they want their teeth to be healthy, but they also brush their teeth because they want to have a nice, bright, white smile and because they don't want their breath to smell when people come over to them. So there's a vanity piece of why they're doing it that is also hard with mental health to get people to understand, because until I'm a person babbling on the side of the street to myself where people can notice it, no one really knows I'm going through a lot. So, okay, I don't need to do anything.
People can genuinely detect if someone is inherently happy and content because they have a positive vibe around them and that draws people in. So you can sense if someone's content and fulfilled and satisfied with life in general. And you want to learn from these people. You don't want to have celebrities coming out and say, I had a terrible time, you know, I have depression, I'm on medications, woe be me. You want to learn from people who survive it, who've lived through it, who are still thriving, and say, what did you do? So for example, Eric, how did breathing help you? And I said, well, if Eric, you know, finds it helpful, maybe I can try it. So I think it's also learning from success stories that are helpful.
Well, you nailed the marketing message that we started with from day one. If you look at our website with all the celebrities making the sign, the stories that I asked them to share, I gave them a story arc with questions. And the questions towards the end are, how did you start to heal? What was working for you? And why do you hope to help other people, right? Because back to like what you were saying, if you have a page full of celebrities who are like, I'm really down deep in it right now, what we're doing is we're creating a society of victims where we're like, by the way, my least favorite term in this entire space, this might be controversial, is it's okay to not be okay. That's become popularized. Why do I hate it? Not because it's wrong, right? It is okay to not be okay, but it's okay to not be okay sometimes. Right? Like when we are just perpetuating
all the time.
Yeah. Right. Like, what are we telling people by saying it's okay to, hey, lay in that bed for the rest of your life because it's okay to not be okay? You're like, what are we doing, people? Like, think about the bigger picture of what you're telling people when you put these marketing messages out there. There's, you know, as humans, we should understand how important the language is, and one word changes things. And I think a very, you know, scary kind of thin line is trying to help people, but then also keeping people in these victim buckets where it's like, you don't ever have to get better because, of course, life is hard. So, you know, we're sorry. We're sorry you feel that way. There's a level of empathy and compassion we need to give, while at the same time, a little bit of a kick in the butt of using what your analogy with the brushing the teeth. This is part of life. This is the stuff we need to do to feel function and be able to have a productive experience here.
Yeah. And I think part of being a psychiatrist is determining which part is normal human behavior, emotions, reactions to life, and which parts are the ones that we need to focus on and work on to help them heal. So yeah, there's a bit of empathy, and I deliver a bit of tough love with it. And and patients prefer that, because a lot of people feel that, yes, I get a lot of tender loving care and a lot of, oh, you know, that's such a sad story, you know, that's so bad. But then they don't really feel they're progressing. Because I tell my patients, if you want to just share your story, share with a friend. They will be empathetic and sympathetic at the same time. But that's not what you're paying me for. You're essentially, I mean, to put it crudely, is you're paying me to kick your butt.
Yeah, you're a brain trainer, the way that someone at the gym is a body trainer.
Yeah, so it doesn't help you if I'm just sitting here going, oh, that's so sad. I'm like, yes, it's sad. Okay, what can we do about it? I'm a doer. I fix things. You know, you're paying me to fix you. And I need you to work with me, because I need you to brush your brain twice a day as a bare minimum, and then start taking the correct amount. So the analogy is, you know, if your doctor prescribed you a course of antibiotics, would you take all 14 days of pills in one go? No. Would you take 3 days and stop? Well, we kind of know that's not a great idea. Or would you just take a few every now and then? But then people say, oh, it doesn't work. You know, it's like, because you're not taking the prescribed course of a treatment. You should do this specific type of meditation X number of times per day for X number of minutes for X period of time. And if you don't follow these guidelines, this is why we do studies on Sudarshan Kriya and different types of breathing, because we can measure what statistically worked for a bunch of people. So that's the best advice I can give you in terms of statistics, but you need to follow the guidelines and follow the prescription. Same with exercise. You know, you can't just go and run a marathon and then not run for the rest of your life and expect to look, you know, fit and healthy. So people also need to understand this concept of prescription, even if it's alternative, holistic, integrative types of modalities.
Completely agree. The stuff that we're talking about is a complete paradigm shift versus everything that is pushed on us in a media type of way with billions and billions of dollars. So when it's crystallized in our minds between the three of us and we understand it, each one of the components that we just described, it's rocking people's world, because they've never been explained it this way. So it's, you know, that's why using the analogies of the gym, using the analogies of the trainer, using the analogies of the brushing of the teeth are so important, because you have to just keep pounding those messages until they become something that's second nature to people.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult, because society and, you know, the way that it's become so consumer sort of driven, it's that, okay, we provide you with the solutions. You know, every time you switch on the TV, it's like, oh, you don't have to do anything, like, we'll give this to you, and it's so easy, it's the click of a button, you just have to pay for it. I think, you know, we're sending this message, and so a lot of people are thinking, well, actually, I don't have to do anything, I can just pay someone to do it for me. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen when it comes to health. Because you live with your body every day, and you have the choice of what food you put into your body, whether or not you're going to do this exercise, whether you're not going to train your brain in a certain way. And yeah, it's actually not very sexy. But at the end of the day, if you do this and you start to change your perception and your body and your reaction, it's empowering, because it's all done from you. It comes from you. And
this we have this guy, Lorena, just to give you an analogy of what you're describing, this guy Chuck Yacoby, he played center for the Pittsburgh Steelers and won a championship with them. Huge guy, 6'6", like 280 pounds. And what he described, what you just said, is that everyone's looking for the Wizard of Oz. So think of the Wizard of Oz storyline, yeah. Right? Dorothy's going through Oz and meandering and meeting people so that she can get to the wizard, and then she realizes that the wizard isn't who's going to help her get back to Kansas. She's got these ruby red slippers on her own. She just needs to click together 3 times, and that gets her back to Oz. Mm-hmm. We have within us the ability to heal ourselves, yeah. But we're waiting for Oz to just, you know, basically wave the magic wand and get us better. And that's not how it works, you know? So I found that cute, that analogy cute, but also really, you know, it's profound when you think about it, because that story is so well known. that you can't rely on someone else to be the magic, right? Like what Vanessa does in the office, as she was describing, is not being Oz, even though she's giving people tough love. She's explaining to people how to use the ruby slippers. That's what she's doing.
And like you said, everybody has the ability to heal. It's also finding and creating that space and giving the right signal so that you start teaching the body how to heal. It gets stuck and it's learned bad habits, essentially, and you need to correct those habits. And having, you know, this is not to say you shouldn't seek help and do it on your own. You should seek help and the correct type of help to teach your body how to heal itself and to recover. So I think as a psychiatrist, that's what I'm here to do, or at least I try. And it's not to just prescribe medications, but it's also to use it. It could be a very helpful tool, but there's always an exit strategy. There's always a plan to help you come off the medication and find a life that is meaningful for you and is healthy for you. And it's different for everyone. And so it's not a one size fits all. Whereas, I mean, this is a really sad story. A patient came to me and said she saw another person and they did a questionnaire. The doctor saw her for 10 minutes, kind of verified all her ticks and crosses and says, you have depression, take this medication. And she said, but don't you want to know why I'm depressed? He's like, no, it's all the same. You're depressed. You should take this. I'm like, okay, so we're just reducing people to a questionnaire and then, you know, out spits a pill option.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it kind of made me sad that my peers can sometimes not be on the same hymn sheet or kind of move forward with the times. And I'm convinced that by reaching out to people like Eric and being with Lorena, we are spreading the right message. And this is how we have to move forward in order for our species to survive, because we're going down the wrong path of medicating and chopping people up into little bits of organs.
It's actually really about finding strength in people, because, you know, even people who may have not had the best start in life, I think their experience of having gone through that, actually, they would have learned a lot of things that they may not actually have been aware of. And I think as health practitioners, one of the skills that we really have to start developing is the ability to start being there and being present for patients, rather than just sort of saying, oh, yeah, it's all the same story. It's actually not, because people are unique and different. And when we actually make connections, it's really about actively listening to what they're saying and being sort of perceptive about the meaning behind the words. And that's what true connection really is. And, you know, I believe that, you know, even in studies showing that people who have diabetes have actually better outcomes if their physicians are more empathetic. I think that's really missing in just this very prescriptive, you know, take a pill or have this treatment and just do this, or, you know, just rely on me to get you better. Like, this is just not really helping people really deeply change and learn those skills and steps to do it for themselves. Because ultimately, something that has to be sustainable in terms of health has to be coming from within us, not because somebody else has expected us to do something, but because we truly believe that this is our purpose and that we do have the skills and the power and the ability to do that with the help of someone who's experienced in getting us there. So yeah, we really resonate with the message that you're trying to send. So thank you so much.
So where can people find you, Eric?
Yeah, so the website is sameheareglobal.org. And all of the social pages are at sameheare_global. We have a podcast. We're all a little crazy as well. and the podcast is this cross section between what's happening in current events and how does that meet with mental health? So we talk about the Naomi Osaka situation. We talk about, you know, we use a lot of sports because sports oftentimes is news. There's a football player, Richard Sherman, who was filmed, unfortunately, by the camera on this house, charging at his father-in-law's door in anger. And his wife was on the phone with 911. You know, he's going crazy right now. He's threatened to kill himself. He's, you know, we can't get him to stop. And then all the media, what do they know? They know labels. So they're like, CTE, he must have CTE brain injury because he's been a football player.
Because everyone watched the movie.
Right, exactly. That's bipolar. That's the manic part of bipolar. He's in mania right now. And I pause, you know, in the episode that we just did, we invite, you know, guests on that have interesting perspectives that we had a football player on to talk about it. And I said, I'm pretty sure every person on this planet has been outside of their house and seen the neighbor screaming and yelling at someone outside of their door, or charging and trying to get in, or having a bottle of alcohol because it unfortunately suppresses bad feelings. Like, that's life. That's mental health. That's interpersonal relationships. Once we start looking at that behavior and we're saying that fits in that bucket of that thing, guess what that does? It lets everyone else point at that and say, that's that thing and I'm not that thing, so I don't have to worry about my mental health. That's the danger of what we do with the media. Yeah. So anyway, I went off on a tangent about the podcast because I think it's important. The same way we have long form conversation here is the only way this topic gets normalized, in addition to the things that we spoke about, is by having conversation about it, marketing messages of it's okay not to be okay. And then another one of my favorites, I'm saying this facetiously, of how are you doing, comma, really, with a really being like really big with the question mark. It's basically me going to Lorena and being like, Lorena, you haven't told me how well you're doing. Tell me now with the spotlight in your eye, really, how are you doing? Like, that's not how human behavior works. You don't get people to open up by like all of a sudden pressing them further. You get people to open up by being like, hey, I've been through stuff myself right now. I'm going through some challenges. You start being a little bit vulnerable, they start being vulnerable back, right? So it's a fascinating, you know, take that, like, I think what comes to us naturally of how to change these conversations is not necessarily the right way to do it. And so there's a nuanced approach that's needed. And that's why it's fun having these conversations, talking with you guys, holding hands. You know, Vanessa, what we didn't talk about, but at the end here, I can just say, like, you're joining this alliance of doctors that we call Same Here Psych, which is people from around the world, doctors from around the world who practice the way that you do. Dr. Pleaner out in Florida, who started this alliance for us, doctors who want to help get to the source and want to help people actually use their ability to heal naturally. If we don't hold hands and have a consistent message, well, then you live in this little village here, we live in this little town here, they live in this city here, and you end up being, the patients are the ones who suffer, because they end up being like me, who lays in a bed for 2.5 years and is like, well, the only thing that I know that's been promoted out there is what I see on TV. So who's the next big hospital that I go to get the next pill, because I check the boxes on those things, and one check the box said depression, the next one said PTSD. So now I got to go and try the PTSD medications because the depression medications didn't work for me, right?
Yeah.
Long way to go.
I mean, with the diagnostic codes we have, I can give literally everybody in this entire planet a diagnosis. You'll find something in there to code someone for something, right?
And Vanessa, as you say that, not only give everyone a diagnosis, every single person can probably fit in multiple diagnoses. That's exactly. That's the thing.
I've
that
got
is,
a few.
Right. Who doesn't walk down the street and at times in their life be like, I don't want to step on the cracks because that feels weird. I want to step in between the things. Is that OCD? To some level, not fully, right? Okay, we could put that in the OCD category, right? Like, it's just, there's so many things that our brains have to do to survive that fit into this category of that could be, you know, this diagnostic label, okay. And so getting, I just think the whole pathology, I understand why doctors need to do it for insurance coding and also patients sometimes feel a little bit safer when they're explained what they have. But what we were just talking about with Sudaharsh and Kriya, I think we would be a much more connected world if we understood our neurobiology changes when we go through shit. And if we can all work on our neurobiology, the way we work on our bodies, we'll start to feel better. That simple message alone will bring people together way more than bucketing people into the PTSD group. You're never going to understand the depression group. You're never going to understand the OCD group. Like, that's where we're at right now.
Yeah. Well, it's more about helping people get together and understand each other and not keep, I feel like with social media as well, people get polarized a lot. You know, there's this alternate reality that people live in because they fed different information and we're growing further apart. So having the Same Here Global network and putting this message out there is really important. And thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you. Look, I, you know, I'll end on this. I keep saying I'll end. I'm leaning on you guys for when the end is. But I think I went through something and was like Western medicine's guinea pig for 2.5 years because it gave me a perspective to see this world in a different way. Like I could get spiritual and be like, shit, why did I have to suffer for that long? Couldn't it have been 6 months and my life was only on hold for 6 months. Why was it 2.5 years? Well, I had to try all these different things. And then in trying all these different things, this idea just came over me of like, we're messaging this in a complete 180 versus how we need to message it to bring people together. I don't take credit for that in any way. It was kind of like the world happened to me. And then you see it, the big picture, and you're like, this is so backwards. So for the topic of Same Here, Vanessa and Lorena, like I'll say, I feel like it's our message. Like it's something that just came and I think everyone can use, and I want people to feel partners in it more than anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's thank great you. Talking to you and we'll connect again.
Awesome. Good stuff, guys. Thank you so much. Have a good rest of the night. Sorry, went so late.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. We'll talk to you guys in a little bit.
You can find us at anantawellbeing.com and follow us at anantawellbeing on Facebook and Instagram. If you like our podcast, please give us a 5-star review to help other like-minded people find us. This podcast is for information purposes only. Statements and views expressed in this podcast are not medical advice and is not intended to treat or diagnose any medical condition. This podcast and its producers disclaim any responsibility for adverse effects that result from the use of this information. Opinions of guests are their own and are not endorsed by this podcast. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions. We do not make any representation or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. Both producers and guests may have direct or indirect interest in the products and services mentioned. If you think you have a medical condition, please consult a licensed physician.